Hi, this is Paul. We are in episode 3 of the Exodus Seminar, Chaos and Order, the Biblical Series. If I recall, again, it was a few months ago that I watched all these. I remember, yeah, episode 3 was a good one. So there's some good stuff coming up. We'll see how far I get.
And Moses answered and said, "But behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, the Lord hath not appeared unto thee. And the Lord said unto him, what is that in thine hand? And he said, a rod, a staff, a walking stick, a pole. And he said, cast it on the ground. And Moses cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from before it."
We just did this text in our men's Bible study. I absolutely love the image of Moses. He flings his staff down, becomes a snake, and he runs away. You can't beat the Bible.
"And the Lord said unto Moses, put forth thine hand and take it by the tail. And Moses put forth his hand and caught it, and it once again became a rod in his hand." Well, there's a lot packed into that, that's for sure. I'll just make a couple of comments and then it'll open up. The staff of Moses and the staff of Aaron, that idea just never goes away after this introduction in the text. And so a staff is something, if you have a staff and you're the owner of a company, the staff does your will, you rely on the staff as well. And so
I don't think I had ever sort of put together the staff and the staff until I see this. Yeah, that is the same word. Well, it's interesting.
And that meaning is a derivation from the same root idea. If you're walking, when you walk with a walking stick, then you can lean on the stick. And so while you're on the way, you have something to lean on. And so the rod is also a symbol of solidity and stability and tradition. And then the rod, the staff, the tradition can turn into a snake. And that means that what's solid and reliable and that you can use on your way can also transform itself suddenly into chaos. So there's a yin-yang dichotomy there.
So I have pastored Livingstones for 25 years and I have never had a staff. And I have colleagues and friends who have had staff. And what he said about they can turn into chaos is totally true.
Emerges. And then after all that, and that's terrifying because when your tradition falls apart and the chaotic serpents emerge instead, then that's terrifying and that's what happens to Moses. But then God tells him, take the serpent by the tail, which by the way is the most dangerous way to grab a serpent because you grab them by the head. And so if you have enough courage to grasp what's dangerous, then you will become credible enough to be listened to. And that's part of the understructure narrative that drives this, in some sense, this magic trick. And then we see the...
Again, I mean, that little move that Jordan made right there, a lot of people will say, ah, see, it's arbitrary. But the reason, part of the reason that Jordan has had so much credibility is in convincing people that it isn't arbitrary, in convincing people that the fact-value distinction isn't quite the thing you think it is, that in fact... meaning is built into the universe and it can be found all over the place. And which is called wisdom. And there was just another great little example of it.
The motif of being exposed to the serpent as a curative process replicated through itself through the text. And we also know that the symbol that even modern physicians use to symbolize their healing power is the symbol of the rod and the staff, which I believe in that case is of Greek origin.
Asclepius.
Right, Asclepius. But there's a parallel there
There's definitely a parallel.
And is that historical replication? Is it archetypal replication?
I think it's archetypal.
Is it derivation from the same source?
It has to be archetypal. We'll see it more when we get to the serpent on the staff itself, that story. We can maybe talk about it then. But it's definitely a universal story. But it's also referring to the serpent and the tree, you know, in terms of...
It's interesting because for Moses, as we're thinking about him as the emergent hero,
And we're talking yesterday a lot about the fact that his ability to engage transformationally is one of the things that's defining. His ability to see and hear God is what illuminates God to him, though God's already independent in Genesis, as we discuss. But the ability to transform the snake, right, into a staff again is the transformational ability that means it's caused to lead, right?
That's the definition chaos of the hero. The hero does both. He casts order into chaos and chaos into order. He's a mediating factor between the two.
That's right. So I always think with the yin and yang, people forget the eyeballs. And the eyeballs for me are like Colossus of Rhodes astride, right, astride the line. Mm-hmm. That's where you want to stand. And so it's good from evil per the tree, the Garden of Eden, but it's also chaos to order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think chaos to order is actually a better way to understand it. It's the rod to that which is flexible, right? A snake is that's why it also says grab by the tail. It's one making you want to understand that it's a tail. It's something that moves and is flexible, isn't solid like a staff. But you can understand it in terms of attention, because that's actually how attention works. It's like you have something undefined. What do? You mentally or physically grasp it.
And when that isn't what understand means. That's exactly. Piaget pointed that out when he talked about children building their what do you call those psychomotor schema to begin with. So the basic preconceptions of perception itself are the gripping element. And so when children are trying to figure out how to see something, and therefore
that's why you take them into a museum, see and don't touch,
to conceptualize and perceive it. That's why they people say sometimes, look with your eyes and not with your hands, right? They'll say that to their little kids, but their little kids are literally gripping the chaos of the world so that they can transform it into something stable and reliable.
And that little puppy of mine doesn't have hands. Everything's in the mouth.
So
it's worth making the obvious point that, you know, both the rod and the snake are symbols of sovereign pharaonic authority. The pharaohs would have had a snake in their headdress. I think
even more than that, not only the snake, but the pharaohs have a rod and a fly swat. And so the fly swat is also that tail. And so it is a rod and a tail.
So the symbolism is that Moses is being invested with a kind of counter-authority, he's becoming the leader of anti-Egypt.
Right. So you have to be the master of the staff and the snake in order to lead.
Yeah. Well, and that's the snake that eats all other snakes.
Right. So that's a representation of his ability to... So and that's so interesting that it's the snake, right? So he's the master of the chaos that eats all other chaos.
Yeah, but
or is
it doesn't
the possibility
say
that swallows
it's the
all
rod
other
that eats the snakes. It's when we get to it, you'll see. We think that it's the snakes, but in my memory, it says that Moses' rod ate the snakes of the.
It's Moses' rod.
Yeah, because that's how it works, right? It's the order that actually that contains. It's actually like grasping the tail. The rod is going to consume the
So it's
the
a superordinate order that can consume all chaos.
Yeah.
And that's what Moses is standing for.
He has
and that's
the best,
why he's an agent of the highest authority.
But you can see it as the law itself. Like it's the law and the transgressions. And so it's like he's able to master, like you said, grab it and it comes back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's also the shepherd's staff, I guess. The sort of imagery of him becoming the shepherd of his people. Mm-hmm. And so the rod becomes the shepherd's crook.
He's chasing away the shepherds even
absolutely,
with his rod.
Yeah, that's right.
Away the shepherd
and defeating the pharaohs.
What does a shepherd use a rod for?
Well, I mean a shepherd's crook, I guess, a staff.
Right, and it's to rein in the sheep. Is that also part of it?
That's
and
right.
To fight off lions?
To lead the sheep, to round them up.
Well, we should remember that when you were a shepherd in that time, that was actually a real man's job, because there were lions and they liked to eat sheep. And so part of being a shepherd was like fighting off lions. And so,
are you implying that contemporary shepherds aren't sufficiently
no,
manly?
No, I definitely I wouldn't dare to do that.
Because we have some contemporary shepherds we can have a conversation with you, doctor.
By the way, the order chaos thing is I'm glad you raised it. And I had not thought of it, frankly, in these terms. But it's for me the central teaching of Genesis. Mm. I always tell people, I think Genesis 1:1 is the most important verse in the Bible, but I think 1:2 is the second most important. Everything was chaos. Mm. And what God does for 6 days is make order out of chaos. So and we are living in the post-God era, and we are living in a chaotic era. And I hope I'm not too contemporary by noting that men menstruate is a statement of chaos.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So again, the centrality of the significance of God.
Well, that's an anti-Rod movement, because Derrida himself said that his deconstructionism was aimed at phallocentricism. It was phallogocentricism, but that degeneration of those categories, especially with regard to male and female, that's not an accidental consequence of the system of ideas. That's a central target of what we use called focal attack. And it is an attack on the rod, fundamentally. So,
I just forgive me, I just want to make one other macro point, because that's how my mind thinks. Many decades of radio and speaking and so on, I have not made the, as much as I believe in God, I truly do, I have never found that arguments for God's existence are nearly as effective or as important as arguments for God's necessity. Mm-hmm. And that's the point that I want to make here, and we're all making here.
And I think that's a great point, and I think it's very true of church. You know, even though relevancy is sort of the way that people go in terms of sort of the last gasp of church as it slides into irrelevance, I think the point that he makes there is exactly right, because again, religion is all about, in many ways, function. And I don't mean that religion is instrumentalized, but deep, you know, why were the Greeks, we look at them as religious, and they would say, no, we're doing sacrifices and going to the oracle and doing all of this because this is how the world works. Why did all of the ancient courts have magicians and theologians and astrologers? Because this was how life works. It's the necessity, and that's why the hollowing out of the world brought about the abandonment of what we look at as religion.
No God, chaos. You don't believe in God, at least understand what the consequences of that non-belief are.
What's interesting about that is we keep having these conversations, and the more that I've been thinking about this in relation to my, you know, forays into the political or cultural world, this is another consequence of how you align the moral with the strategic. And in some ways, what you're saying is if you make a moral argument, people don't even know why they think what they think. So to come in and say to them, you need to change your moral outlook, right? What you're suggesting is, and why I think that's more fruitful, is it's a strategic approach. And that's a way to lead people in, and then they can decide how high up that hierarchy of understanding they want to move.
Well, you can look at this purely psychologically, which I like to do as much as possible, because I don't think you should bring God into the issue unless you have to, in some sense.
See, that's actually, it's sort of a throwaway thing, but that's key again to the way that Peterson gains a hearing from the people that he does. I just finished making that video about Doug Wilson, and Doug Wilson, in a sense, wants to plaster the world with the name of Christ, which, if you grew up in an evangelical subculture, you could see all the time. And I think part of where I see the neo-sacramentalists gaining ground is to recognize that he has found even when his name isn't mentioned. And you find him through the subsidiary and the connecting levels that go all the way up. And I think, again, that's part of why, say, Jonathan Peugeot's vision is more gripping, because what just too quickly jumping to Jesus in some ways diminishes his glory, which is richer because of all of the complexity.
You either are aiming for something unified, which means something at the pinnacle and something that's the highest and superordinate and most valuable, or you're not, in which case perhaps you're aiming down, or you're aiming at a multiplicity of diverse things which are conflictual. Those are your options. And we know that if your perception is fragmented and if your navigation is fragmented, which is a chaotic state, the consequence of that is anxiety and despair, because that's actually what anxiety and despair mark, is that you're confident and secure when you've reduced your plethora of potential passages forward to one path. You know that if you're in a vehicle, it's like, well, are you going one place or 10? If you're going 10, you can't go anywhere and you're confused. You have to be going one place and then everything snaps together and then your nervous system is literally regulated. Anxiety is the response to chaos, the a priori response to chaos.
And again, I hate to go back to my current favorite book, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis. The little bit at the beginning of the chapter, The Medieval Cosmos, characteristically, medieval man was an organizer, a codifier, a man of system. His idea could not be unfairly summed up as a place for everything and everything in its right place. Three things are typical of him. First, that small minority of his cathedrals in which the design of the architect was actually achieved. I am thinking of a thing like Salisbury. Second, the Summa of Thomas Aquinas. Thirdly, the Divine Comedy of Dante. In all these alike, we see the tranquil, indefatigable, I always have trouble saying that word, exultant energy of a passionate, logical mind ordering a huge mass of heterogeneous details into unity. They desire unity and proportion, all of the classical virtues, just as keenly as the Greeks did, but they have a greater and more varied collection of things to fit in. And of course, with the collapse of Rome and the constant striving towards a new Roman Empire. And of course, you know, Rome, just the Holy Roman Empire, Rome just continued to be sort of this organizing principle that in the Latin world they wanted to use and get back to. It was a striving back to order in an extremely violent, chaotic, all of these Germanic tribes, all of the change that goes on. And so, in a sense, the cathedral was an island of peace in the midst of all of that chaos.
Can I ask Dennis a question in light of that? So, Dennis, you said earlier that the necessity of God is the necessity of belief in God is what's going to restore us, what's going to keep civilization on the right track. But is that is it enough to have a kind of psychological, just a psychological sort of stability, a belief that God might exist, or that you should conduct yourself as if God is real, God exists, just as a kind of something that provides you with a kind of psychological unity and stability and order? Or do you think that a culture needs more than that? Is a kind of cultural religion, cultural Judaism, cultural Christianity enough?
Well,
now, of course, this is big into Doug Wilson's Mere Christendom. And what happens in secularism is that they sort of, you know, you sort of put Jesus in the corner. I was thinking today, because I was anticipating my conversation with Justin Brierley, which is out in the member channel now. By the time you get this, it'll be out in the main channel. But the title of his book is The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And throughout the Cold War, a lot of attention was belief in God, belief in God, belief in God. And for a lot of people, just by the virtue of the way language works, that became sort of a thing for people. But I think Prager's point initially is more correct in that it is the understanding. I was going to say understanding is God's place in the universe, but that kind of has its reversed. It's the universe's place in God's reign. And that is where it isn't just believe. It's acting, you know, it's acting as if it's proceeding with the assumption. And that, of course, then becomes the avenue of faith and trust. Because we don't speculate about gravity. We trust that if I'm going to put the little stand down, it falls. And I trust that the car is still in the parking lot and hasn't sort of floated up into space. I trust, and on the basis of that trust, I make all of my decisions moving forward.
Mine's not cultural. I'm not as nice as cultural is.
But you seem to leave open that possibility.
Yes, it's a, I wrestle with that, and I have come down to the, I've come to the conclusion that I offered earlier. The number of people who believe in God and that God is meaningless is enormous. For most moderns, God is a celestial butler. This God, here is my list of what I'd like you to do for me.
Sorry, he's sort of riffing on moralistic therapeutic deism, but Prager has a rather unique position where he asks God for almost nothing. He will list the exceptions. And I'm a Christian. Jesus invites his disciples to ask God for everything and anything. And the way that Jesus says God will answer is just alarming, to the degree that ministers over the centuries have sort of tried to be walking that thing back. Ask and it will be given, seek and you'll find, knock and the door will be open. For everyone who asks receives, and everyone who seeks finds. And, you know, if a son asks for an egg, will he give them a snake? So Jesus is very much saying, if this is your father, ask. Your father won't be offended by a beloved child asking for their needs. Now, the father might not give it. Asking is always asking. And demanding is when things get a little bit more difficult in the relationship. But you can always ask. You might get a no, but you can always ask. So there's nothing wrong with asking.
A great day. I am uninterested. I know this is almost heretical for many of my religious friends. I have asked God in my whole life twice for something, once that my mother not punish me for breaking the vase in the house, and then once as an adult. By the way, in both instances, they were answered. It's a little eerie for me who doesn't ask him for anything. But in all seriousness, I am infinitely more interested in what God wants from me than what I want from God. And that's the way I portray it to people. And they're moved by that, because they know God is not a celestial butler. The number of people who prayed for their dying child and the child died.
He's a heavenly father, not a celestial butler.
Everybody knows that that's the case. So I hate to use the term, tired. Okay, I'm tired of people who say they believe in God, but it doesn't amount.
I'm really glad with this shot they show Jordan listening. And I know there's a lot of video conversations out there where Jordan is not a good listener, but the man who was a clinical psychologist knows how to listen, and I have seen that in person. And this is a good example. He's really listening to Dennis. And, you know, in my conversation with Justin today, you know, Jordan is really seeking.
Don't do anything. Why is God important? Changes minds. That and you know, the founders of America, which I think is the greatest country ever founded, and it may fall over. We're at a crisis point. They knew the importance. They were not all doctrinaire Christians. They were all, by the way, cultural Christians, clearly. But they were.
And I didn't get as far in the Doug Wilson video, but Prager is right. They were all cultural Christians. And the irony about Doug Wilson in dealing with, you know, evil secularism, because no, but that cultural Christianity embedded in secularism was really important and continues to be really, really important. And in many ways has sneakily changed other religions in the world. It's really a remarkable thing. I think when, as secularism recedes, many of us who said, oh, bad, 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 are going to wish it back again, because I think it did a lot.
We're all very God-centered. When Benjamin Franklin is considered a deist, if deist means Aristotle's unmoved mover, none of the founders were deists. They believed in a God who acted in history. Jefferson, this is almost unknown to Americans, Jefferson and Franklin designed a great seal of the United States. You'll find this fascinating. You know what it is? The Jews leaving Egypt. It was not, tragically, it was not adopted. Two of the least Orthodox Christians, small o, were wanted the, a biblical depiction to depict America. The Hebrews left Egypt, we left Europe. That so they knew the importance of God, and a lot of believers don't. And so I just, I'm sorry for talking so long, but...
Johnny, can I?
Thank you.
Can I pick up?
And Prager is sort of the Oz Guinness igniter. Often Prager will talk and it sort of ignites Oz.
But yes, what do. Dennis is saying, another aspect of the American Revolution. You probably know that at the defeat of George...
And the English scholar sips his tea as the Americans go on and on about our glorious rebellion.
At Yorktown, the Hessian and British troops were ordered to play the ballad, The World Turned Upside Down, which was a 17th century ballad and came out of the English Revolution, which came out of the Torah. And the simple idea was, it became various crazy things with the diggers and the levelers and so on. God had created order. Humans had created disorder. So God, to create order again, turned the world the right way up and turned it upside down. And you have in Acts 17, these men who've turned the world upside down have come here. And so on. So, and the original idea of revolution was actually biblical, although today it's almost totally taken over by the left, reordering the world and putting it the right way up. Or again, you just say repairing.
That's a revolution.
Repairing the earth?
Yes, repairing the world under the rule of God, yeah.
So we could say that you could ask the question.
That's interesting.
Not
say repairing.
That's a revolution.
Repairing the earth?
Yes, repairing the world under the rule of God, yeah.
So we could...
That's very interesting. I part of the joy of the last 5 years has been getting to know so many, you know, making friends of observant religious Jews and learning their system, and it's been a great privilege.
Could say that you could ask the question not so much what do you have with God. You could reverse it in the Nietzschean sense. You could say, what do you have without God? Mm-hmm. And then what you definitely have is you have no centralizing axis, you have no highest spirit in the highest place. And so psychologically that means chaos and confusion and internal conflict. And then you have no common spirit that unites you. And so then you have conflict. And so I would say that acting as if is the crucial issue. And I was going over that this morning in a class I was doing on the Sermon on the Mount. And Christ says in the Sermon on the Mount, the ordering of his ethical injunction is something like do and then teach. But it's in that order. But it's not do only and it's not teach only. It's do and then teach. And so you could say you have this internal mimicry of the Father, the Holy Spirit, let's say, the revolutionary spirit in the proper sense, and then you can communicate descriptions of that spirit, and that's the religious enterprise. And we confuse that, I would say, in some sense, with descriptions of external reality. They're not the same thing. The religious enterprise is the description of the animating spirit, and the proper animating spirit, and that's why even in the Exodus story, God is presented as the spirit that calls the hero to lead his people out of slavery. It's not a description of the world. It isn't that the idea that there's wisdom in the world isn't there, but that's not the superordinate idea. And so
That's really interesting. There's a little bit of tension, perhaps, between what Jordan just said and sort of Jonathan's, patterns of the world. The reality lays itself out. Maybe.
I think you need both. You have to have the acting as if. That's the primary thing, because otherwise you're a hypocrite.
The most famous philosopher of the as if is Immanuel Kant of the 18th century. I mean, just the great kind of father of the Enlightenment. And he's often thought to be somebody who does away with God. He's a kind of precursor to Nietzsche in lots of ways. There was a poet called Heine who said that Kant was much more devastating than Robespierre, because whereas Robespierre just decapitated a king, Kant decapitated God. But I think he had this idea that we can't know that God exists, we can't have theoretical knowledge that God exists, but we must so conduct ourselves in the ethical life as if God exists.
Because as free beings, that's the primacy of pure practical reason. So we know its reality as free agents. So you could say in a way that Kant is not actually claiming that, I mean, I think Heine's completely wrong about this, but that it's, you know, God is just a regulative as if, as of. But rather, he is criticizing a notion that, a sort of Aristotelian, Platonic notion, that our, you know, we can know God by contemplating some abstract object. And he's saying, no, we have contact. We have contact with noumenal reality. Right. We have contact with the divine as free agents. So when we obey the categorical imperative, which he thinks is intrinsically linked to the idea of God, that's the kind of knowledge.
We saw that echoed with Moses. I mean, Moses walks by the burning bush, but as we all noted, he does turn to notice. And so I would say we do have access to experience of God if we pay enough attention, and we pay enough attention to the things that, in some sense, transcend our current parochial conceptualizations.
It's helpful. I mean, this conversation has really developed, but remember where it started. It started with Moses is called, God's like, you're my man, you're going to do this. Moses is like, I got a lot of reasons why not. Who, if I go and I say, you know, how do I know? And it's like, well, you're going to be back here worshiping me, and then you'll know. It's like, I need something a little more intermediary. And so throw the staff down and the snake, and that's where we got here. And of course, that's a very tactile, visual, concrete, tangible. It's that kind of proof that we usually want. And of course, I've said many times that miracles don't actually accomplish what we always think they will. It seems to be sort of a little mental trick that happens with human beings, that people will, Douglas Murray says, I'll have to hear a voice. And I'm like, I've seen a lot of people and a lot of answered prayer and sometimes miraculous, and it doesn't do the trick. And my prime example of that is the disciples saw more miracles than anyone, and they saw him firsthand and they saw him connected to Jesus. And when Jesus was arrested, they ran and hid like kittens. So miracles do not do the job, do not carry the weight that we think they carry. And I think that's basically a function of our psychology.
You know, you're quite Kantian in, I think, your approach, Jordan, in the sense that you attend to the structures of subjectivity and the structures of that are uncovered by psychology.
And this is something that Bishop Barron had said about Peterson as well.
Analysis and psychology, but you're also, I think, more, and this is a development, I think, I've not really heard you talk like this until quite recently, this notion of transcendence, not kind of divine transcendence, but somehow that the world beyond, the world as it's given, morality as well, pierces through those that kind of your kind of psychological wrapping. I think that's a development in your thought.
I think that has been deep in terms of his effectiveness with people. That again, so again, back to Lewis, and I just released the transposition video where one of Lewis's big sermons, where Lewis sees the manifest image, the reality that we share, as this is the manifestation and the creation of spirit. And what Peterson, and I think in a sense does, and has always done, but is getting more and more specific and explicit in what he's doing, that he's looking at the manifestation here and working backwards towards the spirit. And he's pointing, and as we watch him do this, you know, the great way to teach is I do, you watch, I do, you help, you do, I help, you do, I watch. It's sort of the simplest way to communicate teaching. And we've been watching Peterson do this, and that's how people start doing it themselves, that we're looking at the Spirit, what the Spirit has done, what the Spirit has created. And again, look at all of the language throughout this series of, you know, the Spirit, this Spirit that's moving, the Spirit that's behind. It's very much the medieval mind of C.S. Lewis. And again, back to the video, let's see, the title of the video was C.S. Lewis Transpositions, Exaptation, Our Coming Spiritual Physical Bodies of the Resurrection.
Just going back to Jonathan's point, there is this, what Kant is doing, and what maybe you're doing as well, Jordan, is separating out what you can say about God. So you're just, Kant says you kind of, we put God behind what we can really know, but we can still have faith in God. We can conduct ourselves as if God exists, but we can't know that God exists. So.
I want to return to Dennis's point. I think it's such an important point. And first of all, with your track record on what you've asked God, I think you would get a little bit more confident in future requests.
I got the requests as God's way of laughing at me.
Yeah.
Just, oh, so you never asked me for anything? Right. Just for that, I will deliver.
Right. And, you really want to burn one of your genie wishes on a vase?
All right, I was 8 years old, all right, hello, okay.
But the point you made that I think is so important is you talked about that you ask, you basically, your relationship with God is asking for responsibility. Like, what is your responsibility? What does God want you to do?
Right.
And that, to me, is the solution. Sorry?
That's a better prayer.
It's a better prayer, but it's also the solution to when you're saying you're in a car and you need to know where you're going, right? We talk, you and I talk all the time about how right now we have an elevation of what people's rights are over what their responsibilities are, right? If you're asking God for things, it's infinite what you might want.
And I think when we use the word rights, we smuggle in demands. These are our demands. And we're going to label them rights so that maybe there's a chance that they can be given. And expectations, that too.
And, you know, thank God for unanswered prayers. There's a reason why that is a cliche that has entered not only the vernacular, but country music. Right. And so part of this is it's infinite if you're dictating your relationship with God based on things you might want. But with responsibility, if you're focused to ask what it is and how you should serve, that's what puts you in a car on a particular direction.
Maybe that's also what helps you know that God exists in some real sense. I mean, there's a paradox in the notion of whether we can know God exists. And the paradox is, in part, you can't know God. And so can you know that something exists that you can't understand? And the answer is, well, then maybe that's why you only see God's back in some real sense, right? You get hints, and maybe you get hints if you open yourself up in the right way. And one of the ways you open yourself up in the right way is not to ask for what you want in the God is a celestial butler manner, but the to ask how it is that you could transform yourself so that you could be a better agent of the divine will or something
right.
like that.
And then what do you find when you do that? When you embrace responsibility, what you find is meaning.
Yeah, well, that seems to be the case.
Well, especially if the responsibility you believe is divine.
Right.
If it's just purely human, I don't know how much meaning it gives.
Well, probably. But what I mean is in your approach.
Yeah, approach that is my approach.
So that is a route to meaning, which is a route to the divine.
Well, the secularists would say, well, you without God, you could still find meaning and service to others. And I would say, yes, that's true. But the reason you find meaning in the service to others is because that's one step on the ladder to the divine.
Yeah.
Oh, ExpressVPN. Hang on. The point I was going to make before ExpressVPN got into my video, even though they've paid me not a dime, neither has Halo. And ExpressVPN and Halo, if you see this, don't bother sending a request. I turn down all of the people who want to do sponsors. Because I don't know. Anyway, I distract myself. Well, the point I was going to make. Oh, back to the metaphor of the back to the metaphor of the author, and I've often used that. Get that from Lewis. How does Aragorn know Tolkien? Aragorn knows Tolkien through Middle-earth and through the way Middle-earth works. And again, this, I think, is key to understanding Peterson's, in a sense, what he keeps doing is sort of a natural theology. He's working his way backward. He's discerning the spirit. And it's a very Romans 1 kind of thing. Romans 1, of course, famously talks about God can be seen, his power and his majesty can be seen by what he has made. And so Peterson keeps starting from that and trying to work his way back. And of course, if you're using the Bible, you're sort of getting a step up.
Well, the people who constructed the gulags, you know, there was a lot of altruism there. There was a lot of cooperation. There was a lot of, you know, there was a horizon of action, and there was planning and so on.
By the way, forgive me, I just want to say, the issue of the consequences of no God is a very powerful impetus in my life to belief. As odd as it sounds, I always tell people, I come to God through the back door, mm-hmm. not through the front door. The front door is God has appeared to you in some way or whatever, and I never knock that for anyone who has that experience. I have not. To me, the most powerful rational argument is the consequences of the death of the divine. When the chaos and indeed ultimately evil that ensues, if I understand that without X, nothing exists, then X must exist. I'm not a physicist. I don't think in the algebraic terms, but that's how I think. The greatest argument for God is what happens without God.
It seems to be, in some sense, the most irrefutable argument. I would say belief the same way. It's like, well, Nietzsche said God is dead, and what's going to happen? His prognostication was, nihilism and psychological catastrophe, and then mass murder on a scale unparalleled, which was exactly right.
But Nietzsche would just call this wish fulfillment. He might say, well, maybe reality just doesn't like us very much.
It doesn't.
But also Exodus would have an answer to that. Like the view, I think, that this text is offering to us is there's nothing outside of God. I mean, there is no, is there God, is there not God? I mean, at least the account of this text, if we can take it seriously, is that, I mean, this text here is that it's all within God. There's no
well,
outside
part
here.
That's part of the divine unity, the divine unity argument.
In a sense, I think what's at least what the text is saying, I think, is that this text is trying to help us have a revelation of what God is. Mm-hmm. That's what the Bible takes itself to be doing. And in this case, the statement that God is this transcendent principle, the source of all being, the origin and, you might say, sovereign principle of all reality, I think is very fundamental here in relation to, you know, we can't simply say Moses goes and he does these things. I mean, the whole language of the text here, and I think the whole argument of Exodus, is that Moses has to bring himself into conformity with that transcendent principle, which is his source. And it's always described as, you know, he says right here in the beginning.
He keeps calling God a principle. And it's like, you know, again, I've been reading The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis, and part of me is like, ooh, I think Lewis would want to the point is right, but he's not a principle. Maybe as a principle in terms of the, he's not a principle, P-L-E. It's too thin.
In the fourth chapter, you know, they're not going to believe me. And he says, well, okay, let me tell you what to do. And it says this comes again and again and again. And God said to Moses, here's what I want you to do.
So there's if you abide by God's word, then people will assume that you're a legitimate agent of God.
And part of that, to James's point about the gulags, which is a very fair point, is we tend to think of this orientation of meaning as being something that is an event. Like there's an epiphany and then it occurs. But when you have meaning, and let's say you're in the car and you know where you're going, there's that also driving in that car and going where you're going has a high likelihood of ossifying into rigidity, right? There's one direction and you're on the path. And what's so interesting to me with this, with there's so many mistakes, right? Like God almost kills Moses later for some reason we don't even know. And then Aaron messes everything up. And it's a constant process. And so faith
rod
is
snake, rod, snake, rod,
right,
snake.
Right, that's right. And so faith is a process. And there's a sort of rigidity that happens immediately of, like, I'm saved, I'm found, I have my meaning, I'm going somewhere. And it's like, well, be careful, because every step of the way, right, the path that you're on has to be renegotiated.
It's supposed to be a humble path, right?
Right.
It's like, I'm on a path and it looks good, but who am I to be so certain? So, yeah, well, I think you could make the Gulag point even more, particularly with the Germans, because the Russians, they just weren't that good at it. I mean, they killed a lot of people, but compared to the Germans, they didn't have that unbelievably disciplined efficiency. And so, in some sense, what made the Nazi catastrophe so utterly horrifying is that what was the greatest in some real sense about Western civilization was subverted most effectively to evil. And that's in no small part, perhaps only because the divine principle had fallen apart. And then it was replaced by the state, for God's sake.
You said something which we're all experiencing it with everybody. There's a gem thrown out and then another point. But I just want to, you said something to the effect that how people behave or is their greatest argument for God or something. Did you recall just saying that? I know you said something analogous, but, and
you will be my witnesses.
It just triggered something that I feel also very keenly. The greatest argument for atheism is never given by atheists. It's given by bad religious people. Good religious people are the best arguments for God's existence, mm-hmm. and bad religious people are the best argument for atheism.
All the people who comment on my biblical lectures who are atheists who've come to appreciate Genesis, they almost all say the same thing. They said, I was so brutalized by bad religious people when I was a kid that it turned me against not only God, but religion.
I have a prayer. May all bad religious people either become good or atheists.
Yeah. So we don't know.
We don't
know how much damage.
That's good.
Now, one of the things that's going around right now is this, there continues to be a lot of question about sort of walking away from faith, etc. Looks like the Keller Center is doing its work. In the last 25 years, 42% of our city, metropolitan Orlando, Florida, has stopped attending church. In 2018, we were two pastors who wanted to understand and be fruitful in what we thought about our unique concept. We soon learned our context wasn't unique, and that what's happening around us wasn't simply as media pundits and Twitter commentators are suggesting. We're living in the largest, fastest religious shift in U.S. history. Some 40 million adult Americans who used to go to church at least once a month now attend less than once a month. The shift is larger than the number of conversions during the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, and the totality of Billy Graham's crusades combined. Part of that, obviously, is a function of population growth. Over the last 2 years, we've worked with respected social scientists Ryan Burge and Paul Juppé to conduct the largest and most comprehensive study of de-churched ever commissioned. In total, we heard from more than 7,000 respondents over three phases and gleaned as many as 600 data points from the final phase of the study. The result of the study, along with a number of pastoral, missiological, ecclesiastical, and relational insights, were published last week in our book, The Great De-Churching. Because the results both confirmed anecdotal experience and challenged accepted narratives, the book garnered interest among a wide swath of our media landscape, write-ups from New York Times, Atlantic, Washington Post, American Conservative, National Review, and even The Ben Shapiro Show, Daily Wire. What did we learn? Misconception number one, people leave primarily because of negative experience with church. That's exactly what they said. And although there certainly are people who do that, it's a misconception. Why? Sadly, egregious malpractice in the American church includes abuse of all kinds, racism, misogyny, political syncretism, and clergy scandals. We must deal with these problems, but the majority of Americans aren't de-churched casualties of this. Are you ready for the number one reason people stopped attending church? They moved. And to get back to Dennis Prager's point, God wasn't essential in their new surrounding. They were probably detached from the network, the family religious network that held them in church. The number one reason was they moved. Roughly three quarters of the people who left church did so casually for pedestrian reasons, including moving, the inconvenience of attending, kids' sports activities, family changes like marriage, divorce, or having a new child. I totally believe this. We in no way want to downplay the hurt and suffering of 10 million who left as casualties. Numerically speaking, that group just isn't the lion's share of de-churched. For an effective response, we must have an accurate picture of who's leaving and why. Most leave casually and often unintentionally. When we were doing church planting, the number one place we looked to plant churches was where people moved to and had no relationships, because that was also the place where, even if they weren't attending church someplace else, were most interested in very pragmatic ways towards entering into a new community. Misconception number two, young people are leaving the church after attending secular universities. We were stunned by what we discovered about the relation between de-churched education and income. According to the secularization thesis, almost all countries became more secular as their per capita GDP rises. Similarly, countries with lower per capita GDP tend to be more religious. See the chart below. But the United States is an outlier, and this held up in our study. Among those we surveyed, people with higher education were less likely to leave the church. For evangelicals, de-churching and education were inversely related. More education, more likely to stay in church. Only 3% of evangelicals with graduate degrees were de-churched. This finding challenges the notion that secular university erodes the faith of many young evangelicals. While the 18 to 30-year-old time frame is a period when people are most susceptible to de-churching, the cause doesn't seem to be secular higher education. De-churching has hit lower and middle class, with those less educated harder. Chris Lundstrom, read Hillbilly Elegy, Mama in Hillbilly Elegy, didn't go to church, believed in God, didn't go to church. There's this sort of folk religion underneath. And in many ways, that's a big part of what's going on. Josh Dawes on Twitter, the evangelical attempt to win leftist cultural elites, often thrown by uneducated working-class conservatives under the bus, has resulted in the uneducated working-class conservatives leaving the church. Good job, everyone. Really well done. He's retweeting James R. Wood's tweet. A few interesting points on this. He was tweeting the article. People aren't primarily leaving because they're hurt, burned by the church. Contemporary American church is doing well with highly educated and successful, but not well with working class. De-churching happens disproportionately on the right, which is just absolutely fascinating. Misconception three, people leave the church because they've left the faith. Misconception four, the people leaving are primarily on the secular left. The earliest to de-church in the late 80s and 90s to mid-90s were more left-leaning politically. But by 2023, evangelicals are de-churching at almost twice the pace on the right political flank than they were on the left. Admittedly, there were fewer de-churchings from the secular left because many of the people had already left the church. Still, for discernible groups, right-wing politics has supplanted the church from a belonging standpoint. People who find meaningful community in political spaces have lower motivation to keep going to church. So ministers must be leaders who can see and respond to challenges that come from multiple directions at once. Misconception number five, they aren't willing to come back. I'd say that's true too. Well, I think this looks like a good place to stop. Again, I'm sort of doing shorter segments. I'm finding I can, if I'm going to get through this whole thing, I need a strategy. And a lot of what I did way back in 2017, 2018, when I would sort of sit for an hour and a half or 2 hours at a setting to go through Genesis, which I never actually got through that. Part of the reason was my schedule was different then. I didn't have as many responsibilities with all of y'all in a lot of different ways. But this might actually be more sustainable. We'll see if I can do it in sort of bite-sized segments. So this was another. Now with YouTube chapters, you can sort of see the chapters where they kind of broke it up. So, all right. Leave a comment. Thanks for watching.